Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. By now, you've probably heard the name George Floyd mentioned many times over the past few weeks, but have you heard the name Darnella Frazier? Because without Darnella Frazier, the 17-year-old bystander who filmed the killing of George Floyd under the knee of a Minneapolis police officer, we might be in a very different place than we are now as a country. George Floyd's case might not have garnered the national attention it has, and the protests against police brutality might not have swept across the country with the furor they have. We know that cases of police misconduct are not simply happening more, but rather that technology is now widely available to capture it, with video recording capability on cell phones in the pockets and hands of nearly every American. But what are your rights when it comes to recording police, and how do you do it safely and ethically? Joining us now is Sam Gregory, Program Director for Witness, a nonprofit organization that supports the use of video and technology to protect and defend human rights. Sam, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me on.
And listeners, we want to invite you to join this conversation. Our phone lines are open. If you have a question for our guest, Sam Gregory, or you want to share a comment, give us a call, 800-222-9455. That number again is 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show. That's at 21st Show. Sam, as an activist who advocates, trains, and supports people to use video and technology to defend human rights, I want to get your impression of the George Floyd video from the standpoint of how it was filmed and who filmed it, the 17-year-old named Darnella Frazier. What can we learn from her?
I think the first thing we have to point out is that there's tremendous courage to keep filming for those almost 9 minutes and to keep filming as a young African-American woman in that context. The first thing we see so often in these cases is how witnesses take risks to film, and the risks are greatest for those who are within their own communities and are themselves vulnerable. So I think that's the first thing we should do, is applaud that courage and recognize it. It carries risks with it. The second thing is, that they made a choice to really show what happened. They didn't allow the police to get away with a narrative of what might have happened, or say you didn't see the beginning or the end. That piece of footage shows the whole story very sadly and horribly of the end of George's life as he's killed by the police officer. And the third thing, and we should, as we think about how these videos are used to lead to justice, is she released the video after the official account had come out that claimed, in fact, neglected to even mention how George Floyd died. It was just an anodyne Minneapolis Police Department report that didn't mention he had had someone leaning on his neck for all this time as he pleaded for his life. And she made a very strategic decision in retrospect to wait until that report came out and show what had happened.
Interesting. So, we've seen examples of this all over the country, including locally in Urbana, Illinois, where the case of Alaya Lewis's April 10th arrest may still be fresh in the minds of some listeners in the community. In that incident, two separate bystanders filmed her arrest, and shortly after, many called it an example of the police using excessive force. Sam, I realize you might not have seen the Alaya Lewis video, but I wonder if you can just talk generally about what sort of power video can have in igniting social movements, both on a national level, like we're seeing now with George Floyd, but also on the local level.
Video can have tremendous power. It's a tool that shows what many communities know was happening to them. And of course, there is this reality of structural and systemic racism in this country. There's a quote that I always remember from Ta-Nehisi Coates where he says, "The violence is not new, it's the cameras that are new." And so we're now seeing all this violence, and we're seeing it systemically. We're seeing that there are patterns. And of course, that has happened even more so in the last 10 days, where we've seen, the scale of police violence directed towards protesters and others. So it's a powerful igniter of social movements. Because it makes it hard to deny what's happening. It makes it hard to deny the systemic nature. And it makes people who could otherwise turn their heads away, it forces them to focus. Now, that's not without its cost. The other thing that we know is that as many African-American writers and activists have said that it's tremendously traumatizing that people feel like they have to see these videos in order to believe what African Americans and other people of color have said about violence in this country. Why is it that we need this necessity of the video to do it? The other place where the video can make a difference, and we have to be careful here, is it sometimes can lead to prosecutions. But if people expect that any video, even if it feels like it's incontrovertible, will lead to a prosecution, the sad reality to date is that doesn't happen. Many people shoot videos, they release them, and nothing happens. And so part of our work is also trying to make sure that if you are that witness who very courageously does show what's happening, how do you make it more likely that, as well as contributing to these systemic movements, it will lead to the prosecution or the accountability for an officer, a policy, or a department?
If you're just joining us, this is the 21st. We're talking with Sam Gregory, Program Director of Witness, a non-for-profit organization that supports the use of video and technology to protect and defend human rights. And listeners, we invite you to join our conversation with your questions for our guests or your comments. Give us a call, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. You can tweet us at 21st Show. So, Sam, I want to talk about some of the details of, or the sort of nitty-gritty of actually doing this recording work. There was a recent article called How to Safely and Ethically Film Police Misconduct in Teen Vogue, written by one of your organization's activists, Palika McComb. And she points out that, as you were just saying, videos are not always recorded in a way that can be used as evidence in legal proceedings. And I wonder if you can talk about why that is, and what should someone who is recording keep in mind to maybe help ensure that their footage is real and might be more likely to be used as admissible evidence in a court proceeding.
Yeah, so my colleague Palika is the expert within our organization on this. It's been doing a lot of work, obviously, to help people around the country, including many people who this is their first experience even thinking about this. So our starting point, first of all, is to say, think about safety and know your rights. I think that comes before you even start filming. You have to know what is safe for you and the people you film. And this is a real opportunity for white people, particularly, to say, I can film in situations where, in fact, it's more likely that a person of color will be assaulted or attacked if they tried to document the police. So that's a starting point. And it's also a starting point that in the US, you do have a right to record. What that means is you can film the police as long as you obey their instructions to not interfere. That is at their discretion, so you have to be really careful because they can say you weren't complying and use extra legal or legal force against you. But that's the first place, is to know you can do this and to make sure you're ready to film. So we recommend people do things like use a 6-digit password on their phone so that a police officer can't look at your photos or video or try and delete them, and to back up your footage to the cloud in case your device is taken or destroyed. So now you're in a place where you can film, and then the question becomes, as you say, how do you make it more likely it'll stand up as evidence? And there's two sides to that. One is you might describe it as tell a story with your footage. And by that, I don't mean, you know, tell a fiction. I mean, show someone who wasn't there what they need to see to understand what happened. So how many officers were there? What uniforms were they wearing? Were they wearing masks? Were they observing social distancing in the current context? Did they use excessive force? Did they use racial slurs? What types of weapons did they use? And did they use them in a way that later you might see if that complied with policy? And do they have visible badge numbers? And can you document that? So those are just practical things about showing people what happened. And also, as you film, making sure you're not unnecessarily exposing other people to being seen in the footage. So filming protesters' feet or backs rather than filming the actions of protesters rather than the actions of law enforcement. And then the second part is to deal with the challenge that in the current climate of misinformation, people say that nothing is real, right? So they're going to say it was filmed in a different spot or from a different year. And sometimes that's true. We've seen recycled footage happening. But filming things like street signs and landmarks, filming something that has the date and time on it. And one thing that Darnella Frazier did, and you know, in that incredibly courageous act of filming continuously and in a way that makes it easy to understand what happened. So again, technically, you know, don't shake your camera around, take slow pans, 10 seconds to show people what's happening. So it's both technical, but it's also choosing what you film in a way that challenges people claiming it's false and also provides the information that people can use to pursue accountability.
And I want to back up and kind of get into this. One point you mentioned there is this idea of interfering with police, which, as you said, is at the discretion of police officers. Can you offer any guidelines for things like, you know, what to do if the police do, you know, tell you to back up, for example, or even demand to see your phone or your footage? What legal protections do you have?
So you do have the right to film. If the police tell you to back up, you are obliged to back up. And we encourage people to keep a 6-foot distance from a police officer should be a reasonable distance. One thing you can do is if a police officer gives you an instruction like that, you can film your feet as you back up and say, I'm complying with your order. So there's no doubt about that you were complying with their order to move back. So it's important to recognize that the right is not unrestricted. They do not have the right to look at images on your device. They do not have the right to seize your device. They do not have the right to smack a device out of your hand, or as we saw in a protest piece of footage I was just looking at today, smash their helmet into your camera in order to stop you filming. So all of those are not okay. And you need to be careful that they don't use this obligation to comply with a legitimate instruction to back up as a way to use it against you. And we know that historically, and we've looked at case studies from the past 5 or 6 years of people using cameras to document, that often this right to record is ignored. Often people try and seize cameras. Often they try and trump up an additional charge as retaliation.
If you're just joining us, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking with Sam Gregory of Witness about using video to film police encounters. You can always join our conversation, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. Let's say hypothetically, as a witness, you filmed an interaction which may show police misconduct. How do you then go about sharing it ethically and effectively? Should you, you know, go to social media, call the local news outlet you trust most, or go to the state's attorney's office, which is our prosecutors here in Illinois? What do you do with the video?
I think, just as I said at the beginning, when you're thinking about filming, you should pause and think about safety. When you film something, you should pause and think about sharing. And I think there's a couple of key questions you need to ask. One is, am I about to expose someone to significant risk in the footage who has no idea they've been filmed or knows they're being filmed, but you've just captured something that could be either tremendously important to protect them, for example, this is about to be a spurious arrest or prosecution, or is going to increase the risk to them. And we know that people are targeted who are seen in footage, both by right-wing activists and by police. So thinking, for example, do you need to blur a piece of footage for the piece you release publicly? And there are a number of tools you can use for that. In photos, the secure messaging app Signal has just released a tool to blur a photo very easily. It's harder with video. The best tool, but it doesn't always work, is one that YouTube has on its platform that enables you to blur a video. So that's the first step, is, you know, safety. Who's going to be in danger by this? Do I need to protect anyone? And then the second question is, how do you share it? And this is a dynamic question, right? I think there's real value with some of this footage in releasing it rapidly into the social media environment right now because of this cumulative impact of seeing what's happening. But from our experience over time, we've seen that often the most effective strategy is to hold back, to try and engage with a local advocacy organization, a local lawyer, the family of someone who may have just been assaulted or faced violence, to ask what they want. And that's both ethical, right, that releasing this footage of someone being brutalized into the public space is something we need to be careful about. And the second is practical. We've seen in the cases that are around prosecutions, particularly of single incidents, so not these protest footage where there's often many people filming, but where there's just one witness, that releasing it strategically, for example, after the official police account has come out, is much more likely to lead to justice. And this happened in, you know, one of the most notorious cases, the case of Walter Scott, who was shot. The witness in that case released the video after the police account stated that he'd been fighting for a weapon. The footage clearly showed it didn't. So it's really important to take that pause to think, who do I need to protect? Who do I need to ask if they want it shared? And then as I share it, what is going to be the most strategic to the moment I'm in?
You know, and we've only got a couple of minutes left in our conversation, but after the killing of Eric Garner, Ramsey Orta, Garner's friend who filmed his death at the hands of Staten Island police, say he became the target of local police harassment. You mentioned that people should pause and think about sharing. What do you say to people? And then, you know, there's also this question of when you're in the moment, this can be really a chaotic encounter. I'm sure there's fear involved. How do you advise people to maintain their composure and also think through all these ramifications of what could happen?
Yeah. So that's partly like literally just saying to people, pause and breathe. Sadly, the reality is obviously these cases go on for years in terms of their ramifications and hopefully the justice. So the time it takes you to breathe, talk to someone else about what just happened, talk to the family of someone who's just been arrested or a friend of theirs and understand what they want done, is time really well spent, even in this chaos. This fact that prominent witnesses to police violence are often harassed, and Ramsey Orta is a prominent case. He's actually just been released from prison. And he faced harassment and charges that may have been trumped up against him, but harassment when he was in incarceration because of his role. And it took a long time for any semblance of accountability for that killing of Eric Garner to happen. We see that pattern all too often, is that witnesses are harassed. So one other thing that we're saying when we say hold off is you might want to release it through someone else, right? Is there an advocacy organization that can share the footage? Does it have to be you as the person who's named and harassed and attacked for your act of courage? So I think that's really important. And it also takes me back to the role of people who are more institutionally privileged to do this, right? It's not the responsibility of people who themselves face violence and harassment to be always the ones who have to show this. Like if you're a white person with relative privilege and you see this, you should be filming because you are institutionally and systemically safer in this country than African-Americans and people of color.
All right. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. We'll tweet out the article we mentioned and more links if people want to learn more about this. Sam Gregory of Witness, thank you for being with us today on the 21st.
Thank you, Brian.
More to come after a short break. Stay with us.